From Michigan to Texas, Nebraska to Maryland, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, December's jobs report was disappointing, but there is some positive economic news. Michael Farron from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University joins us with details. Democrat efforts to nuke the Senate filibuster to enact a federal takeover of elections has failed. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. COVID-19 cases have surged in recent months amid a shortage of test kits. The Biden administration's response is to send out millions of free masks. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine reports. And on this week's American Radio Journal commentary, Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College talks about the importance of conscientious objections to vaccine mandates. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The U.S. economy is struggling to return to pre-pandemic levels, and a disappointing December jobs report shows we still have a way to go. But there are some hopeful signs. Michael Farron is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. He is here with analysis. Michael, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Michael, as we enter the new year, of course, the employment numbers for December, the last month of 2021, are out. A bit of a disappointment. Want to tell us what they showed?
So the jobs report was both good and bad in separate ways. And this has been a trend that has been repeated multiple times in the past several months. First off, the number of jobs created, new payroll jobs, was a very disappointing 199,000. That would be great for pre-pandemic times, but we're still recovering to the pre-pandemic times. And economists had projected as many as 422,000 jobs would have been created instead. So we missed the mark there. But more importantly, the unemployment rate decreased to 3.9%. So that's actually breaking the 4% lower threshold is quite a good thing. And that's compared to 3.6% in December 2019. So we're just about recovered to a pre-pandemic unemployment rate. And similarly, the raw number of unemployed workers who are actively seeking a job decreased to 6.3 million, which is just barely larger than the 5.9 million we saw in December 2019. And even better, the number of workers on temporary layoff has declined to more or less exactly what it was pre-pandemic. So on a number of metrics, we have returned to what the labor market was like prior to the pandemic, even with that disappointing jobs growth. The but is the workforce is about 3.6 million workers smaller than we would have otherwise expected for a pre-pandemic comparable workforce. And on top of that, there are millions of fewer jobs as well. But we should be more focused on the number of workers in the workforce, because two part-time jobs can be combined into a full-time job. So looking at simply the number of payroll jobs is not quite the right way to go. We're looking more at workforce participation. So the question is, in light of increasing wage offers and employers looking high and low for any workers that will come work for them possible, you have to ask yourself, where are all the workers that we would have otherwise expected to be in the labor force?
Let's talk a little bit more about that. Is this a situation where a number of workers or former workers are not, as you said, actively seeking employment at this point, but a major change is we have come to the end of this monthly child tax credit check that a lot of American families had been receiving, thus enabling them to stay home to, in fact, provide child care. So can we expect that that will create a bit of a surge of folks returning to the job market?
You would really expect so. The question is how much? Those 3.6 million people that I calculate as being on average or an estimate of the number of people we would expect to be back in the workforce if this were a pre-pandemic equivalent workforce. That number, actually two-thirds of it, is people who are retired. And on top of that, so we only need to regain about 1.2 million people who are in prime working years between the ages of 25 and 54. And so it's those people, I think, that we are really thinking about in terms of, is their return to the workforce being inhibited by pandemic era relief programs like the expanded child tax credit? Arguably, yes. But as we saw with the end of the federal expansion and extension to unemployment insurance benefits, there wasn't a huge surge in people returning to the workforce after that. There's a couple reasons why this may be the case, and we can go into them, but I am past the point of making any concrete predictions about whether there will be surges of workers returning to the labor force at this point.
Economic predictions are always a bit of hazardous territory, but as we look at the workforce, we hear not only anecdotally, but we have survey research that shows many companies, many businesses, particularly the service sector, unable to find enough of employees to maintain their business hours and stay open. Is this a situation, Michael, where the economy really does need more people to get back into the active workforce?
If you ask business owners, they would certainly tell you yes. And I think to a good extent, you're starting to see the problems that occur when you don't have enough workers. There was a Thai restaurant near me here in Arlington, Virginia, that I like quite a lot. And they were only offering two tables for dine-in customers because they just didn't have enough workers to be able to service more tables than that and then provide food delivery and food production for people who were making to-go orders. So you're definitely seeing the effects of workers not returning to the labor market. And what you might end up seeing as a result of that is businesses shifting their production processes and the technologies that they use to a world or to a paradigm that needs less labor as a result. You've seen some of this when the minimum wage increases, in particular near me in Washington, D.C., as the minimum wage was set to increase, some restaurants were shifting toward a more quick delivery type option where they were no longer going to be a full service restaurant. They were going to be you order at the counter or you order through their app and then go and pick up the food and take it to the table yourself and almost cafeteria style in a way. And so that is one of the ways that businesses would shift to accommodate fewer workers, because if you can't raise prices enough and raise wages enough to attract workers in, then you have to do something else to be able to serve customers, and changing your production process is one of those things.
We have been talking with Michael Farron, who is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center, located at George Mason University. Michael, tell us just a bit about George Mason University and the Mercatus Center, and also where can folks go to read your writings on all of these various economic topics that we have discussed today?
The Mercatus Center is a research center located at George Mason University, and its role is to study markets and the impact they have to benefit people's lives. You can read more about our research at mercatus.org, and you can follow me on Twitter at Michael D. Farron. Thank you.
Michael Farron of the Mercatus Center. Michael, thank you again for being here.
Thanks, Loma.
At the Club for Growth, Scott Parkinson standing by after a very busy couple of days in Congress. Scott, good to have you here.
Well, it's great to be back, Loma. Thanks for having me.
Big battle in Congress. Democrats, President Joe Biden, Democrat leaders in the Senate were trying to pass essentially a federalization of the election process, which belongs properly with the states. There was a big fight over the filibuster, whether to get rid of it or keep it. What was the outcome of the fight?
Yeah, well, we talked about this a little bit last week during the program. And the bottom line is Senator Chuck Schumer decided that he was going to plow forward and force that vote on whether or not we would change the rules of the Senate in regards to how they end debate and move to final passage. A lot of people know that is the filibuster, and the process is known as invoking cloture in the Senate. And so he did what's known also as a procedural maneuver known as the nuclear option and appealed the ruling of the chair on what it takes to pass a bill. And that procedural vote failed 48-52. Two Democrats voted with all the Republicans, and we predicted this would happen last week. It was Senator Joe Manchin once again from West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona. And when we look at these two senators, they've been very clear that they don't want to weaken or change the legislative filibuster. They want to have bipartisan agreements that the Senate has been known for reaching over the duration of our country. And so that vote obviously failed this week. Joe Biden is sort of in disarray. He's trying to figure out and scramble how does he get any of his agenda through. There's folks that are starting to now distance themselves from Bernie Sanders. You remember how excited they were when Bernie Sanders wrote that first iteration of the Build Back Better plan? Well, now Joe Biden had a press conference this week where he said that he's nothing like Bernie Sanders and he's not a socialist and he's a mainstream Democrat and blah, 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 right? We've heard it all before. These politicians will say anything to try to save face. But the bottom line is Joe Biden is losing his base. His approval rating is upside down. And I think that he's entering a lame duck stretch of his presidency.
After just 1 year in office, and it has been just about exactly 1 year since President Biden took office, Scott. So the Build Back Biden plan, the effort to end the filibuster, all of this has ended in failure for the Biden administration. He also faces some significant foreign policy challenges as well, particularly when it comes to Russia and the Ukraine. Can you go into a little bit of detail about what is happening there?
Well, once again, we go back to the press conference that Joe Biden had this week on Wednesday. Biden was asked a bunch of questions about what's going on between Russia and Ukraine, and Biden said that Russia would be, quote, held accountable if it invades, but then he added that it, quote, depends on what it does. So he's saying it's one thing if it's a, quote, minor incursion and we end up having to fight about what to do, but he says it would be different if Russia launched a full-scale invasion of Ukraine. He called that a disaster for Russia. So the bottom line is here, Biden has always made foreign policy blunders. He used to be the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. We all know how he felt in the Situation Room about whether or not to take out Osama bin Laden. Even Barack Obama overruled him on that decision. And, you know, here he is stepping in what I would call a big cow pie in foreign policy when it comes to Russia and Ukraine. So obviously that's a situation that all the foreign policy experts are closely monitoring. I think that President Biden's communications team in the West Wing probably has a lot of work to do, a lot of cleanup is what I would call it. And we'll see exactly how this thing plays out really over the next couple of months.
Well, the president certainly has stepped into a number of, as you put it, cow pies in foreign policy, and most notably the disastrous withdrawal from Afghanistan last year. Scott, all of this has contributed to, as you said, a job approval rating of now down to under a third of the American public, which is at or near historic lows. So we're entering a very big election year. Control of both the House and Senate are at stake. So how long is it going to be now, in your opinion, before members of his own party are going to start distancing themselves in order to save their own seats into Congress?
Well, you know, you don't want to lose the base. And the progressive base is the one that votes in the Democratic primaries. So I think you'll see a little bit of cozying up to even people like Bernie Sanders and AOC and the Socialist Squad. You don't want to completely go up against your president at this point because that can still be a vulnerability. You know, his overall disapproval rating is, like you said, upside down. 538 has the average at disapprove 53.1 and approve is only 41.8. That's an average of all polls, right? So when you even get the left-wing polls out there compared to maybe some of the more right-wing polls, the average is a big, big gap of over 11%. And that's a real fortune-telling exercise for Biden's political prospects when it comes to maintaining his unified government with a Democratic Senate and House of Representatives. I think that right now, redistricting is still playing out in a lot of these states. We don't know exactly what that means for partisan voter rolls. Really, what that means is how many Democrats versus how many Republicans are in a congressional district, what the demographics look like. There's some states that have requirements to maintain a balance for folks based off of race. And so we're certainly watching to see what the courts and what the state legislatures decide when it comes to finalizing the congressional maps. But in the United States Senate, they're not going to change the lines, right? We know exactly what the states are. The bigger question is there any sort of election reforms that legislatures undertake given the era of two-year, if you can call it, emergency? But we're going to be watching the states closely as well. We know that Republicans are at a bit of a disadvantage when it comes to the number of seats that we have to defend. But there's definitely still a few pickup opportunities.
And we are going to be keeping a very close eye on all of this with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. And Scott, a bit about the club.
Sure. The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. We've got over 500,000 members from all 50 states in the country. And if your listeners want to check us out, the website is clubforgrowth.org. You can actually sign up to become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
The Biden administration failed to plan for enough test kits to deal with the surge of the Omicron variant. Now they think free masks are the answer. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine takes a closer look.
Well, we finally got some much-needed good news on the COVID-19 front this week. Yes, it looks like the Omicron variant has crested in the country. Cases are falling pretty much day by day in places that had previously been big-time hotspots. And so, of course, this means it's the perfect time for the federal government to roll out a new plan to get fancier, more effective masks into the hands of every American. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. Today, we're taking a closer look at one of the more bizarre tidbits of news that I've come across so far in this admittedly young year. I'm sure there will be weirder stories to come. But we learned this week that the federal government has been hoarding about 750 million N95 masks. Yes, sitting on that huge stockpile of N95 masks, while at the same time, federal officials have been telling everyone that that's exactly the mask we should all be wearing now. And of course, now that the Omicron variant is in retreat, everyone's going to get them for free. The White House announced that plan, the plan to distribute hundreds of millions of free N95 masks to pharmacies and healthcare centers around the country earlier this week. And from those places, from those pharmacies and healthcare centers, you'll be able to get those masks for free. The Associated Press reports that this move is meant to encourage Americans to replace their cloth masks with alternatives that better defend against the Omicron variant of COVID-19. And look, in places where mask wearing is mandated by government policy, at least some people, I'm sure, will be happy to swap out their current masks for those free N95s that they might be able to find at their local pharmacy. Because, of course, if this plan goes anything like the distributions of free vaccines and the free COVID tests, then we know pretty much how this is going to go. Some places will run out of them immediately, and others will just have tons of them on hand because nobody's going to buy them. Nobody's going to take them, I guess I should say. And they'll still be there when the next pandemic arrives. But the timing of this is just really weird. Wouldn't it have made more sense for the White House to order the distribution of those masks months ago, back when Omicron first arrived in the United States and when federal officials began pushing Americans to wear N95 masks instead of the more basic cloth face coverings that most people have been using throughout the pandemic? But that in turn raises some interesting questions about the national mask stockpile itself, where these hundreds of millions of masks will be distributed from. Media reports this week say that that stockpile currently contains about 750 million masks. Now keep in mind, every mask that went into the federal stockpile, that is every mask that will now be made available, quote unquote, for free through the White House's new program, every one of those masks is a mask that could have already been in use weeks or even months ago if it had not been put in the federal stockpile. I guess back there behind all the federally stockpiled cans of beans, maybe. Maybe that's why federal officials couldn't find them. In fairness, the stockpile wasn't actually that big back in March of 2020. Politico reported this week that federal officials have been working to replenish the stockpile since the earliest days of the COVID-19 outbreak, when the stockpile was actually pretty effectively distributed to healthcare centers, hospitals, places that needed masks early on. But that's only really a half answer to these questions that I have, because it's also worth asking whether replenishing that stockpile was really the best use of federal resources in the middle of an ongoing pandemic. For months now, Biden and his top public health officials have been urging Americans to wear N95 or the similar KN95 masks as a better defense against the Omicron variant. But at the same time that they've been saying that, federal officials have apparently also been removing millions of masks from the market in order to replenish this federal stockpile. It's a question of priorities. It seems like the federal policy here has been that it's more important to have a few hundred million masks in storage for some future event than it was to have them out in the market to be able to be used to fight the current pandemic. Now, America produced an estimated 1 billion high-quality masks, these N95 masks, last year. So we're no longer experiencing the sort of dire shortages that marked the first year of the pandemic. But even so, masks have not been as readily available as they could be. It was widely reported late last year that many Americans were turning to counterfeit N95s because of the difficulties in purchasing the genuine article. And just last week, as Politico noted in their coverage this week, Biden talked about how obtaining high-quality masks is still not affordable or convenient for some individuals, and that's the justification for the federal government distributing them for free. But shouldn't his administration have to answer for contributing, at least in part, to that problem? Why was the federal government stockpiling masks at a time when those same masks, per Biden's own remarks, were very much in demand and some people couldn't get them? So all that was really accomplished here was time-shifting the availability of those masks, because that's what a stockpile is meant to do, right? It doesn't matter what you're stockpiling. What you're doing is you're taking resources out of the market at a time when demand is low and supply is high, and you're going to then later deploy those resources at a time when there's a crunch in supply or a sharp increase in demand. But it's certainly questionable, and it's a question we should ask about whether that time shift in this instance was a productive one. The White House took hundreds of millions of masks out of the market over the last few months or year or so, and after the Omicron wave is now crested and started to recede across most of the country, it is going to make those masks available for free. But if the distribution of masks from the federal stockpile takes as long as the White House's planned distribution of free COVID tests, that means they likely won't be arriving in pharmacies and health clinics until early February. So the operative question here is, the bottom line to all of this is this question: are Americans better served by getting free masks in February than they would have been to have a higher number of high-quality masks available for purchase in October, November, and December of this past year when the Omicron wave was hitting? And that's an equation that I don't think breaks in the Biden administration's favor. It's just yet another example of how the government, through its attempts to control every aspect of this pandemic, has only contributed to making it worse. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out more of our coverage of the coronavirus pandemic and everything else going on in Washington this week at Reason.com, and catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The right of conscientious objection is deeply embedded in our national culture, and it is being cited by some opposed to vaccine mandates. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College talks about it on this American Radio Journal commentary.
The U.S. Supreme Court has declined to stop a state vax mandate for healthcare workers invoking religious objections. It declined to halt New York Governor Kathy Hochul's denial of the First Amendment religious rights of healthcare workers. Only three justices stepped forward to intervene: Neil Gorsuch, Samuel Alito, and Clarence Thomas. Gorsuch denounced New York's intention to fire workers and strip their unemployment benefits. He said that this undermining of First Amendment freedoms, quote, alone is sufficient to render the mandate unconstitutional, unquote. Gorsuch added in his 14-page dissent, today, we do not just fail the applicants, we fail ourselves. Among those failed, Gorsuch pointed to two New York City Catholic physicians who object to the vaccine's incorporation of aborted fetal cell lines. He wrote, quote, "These applicants are not anti-vaxxers who object to all vaccines. Instead, they cannot receive a COVID-19 vaccine because their religion teaches them to oppose abortion in any form," unquote. An added injustice is that these healthcare workers were the frontline first responders when New York was first under siege from COVID. In fact, many acquired natural immunity from that exposure. They feel an ingratitude from their governor. Sadly, not only are religious rights not being respected, but they are being suspected. Increasingly, as the pandemic has worn on, supporters of forced vaccination are insisting that many Americans seeking religious exemptions aren't actually religious. They're faking it, hiding behind phony faith claims. What really is religious? The New York Times asks. To be sure, one would hope that most people making religious appeals are genuinely religious. Surely some are not. On its face, this seems a legitimate criticism. But think again. In fact, dig deeper into the history of American religious conscientious objection. Yes, note the crucial second word there, conscientious. From the start of the religious appeal process against COVID mandates, I've been concerned that these appeals are more often labeled by employers as religious exemptions. They ought to be called religious conscientious exemptions. That is, appeals based not merely on one's religious faith, but on conscience. That is a crucial distinction. Conscientious objection, of course, has a long and noble history in America. There are few more honored rights in our Judeo-Christian tradition. One of our most revered founders, James Madison, father of the Bill of Rights, insisted that an individual's conscience was a possession more sacred than his castle. Just as one has the right to property, one has the right to conscience, which the state should not infringe upon. In fact, it's part of an eternal nature that transcends the mere physical. Madison said that, quote, "All men are entitled to the full and free exercise of religion according to the dictates of conscience," unquote. This freedom has served America so admirably for centuries, from conscientious objectors in World Wars I and II to the Vietnam War, from the appeal of citizens as diverse as the Quakers, Mennonites, Sergeant Alvin York, Desmond Doss, Muhammad Ali, the Berrigan brothers, Martin Luther King Jr. Today, it's appealed to by the likes of Hobby Lobby, the Little Sisters of the Poor, and Kim Davis. Liberals are aggressive supporters of conscience when it comes to, say, refusal to fight in an unpopular war, but they suddenly spurn it for the Baptist florist or Christian cake baker who begged to decline serving a same-sex wedding, or now for millions of Americans claiming rights of conscience against mandatory vaccine. In short, modern Americans stand on firm ground whether they appeal to their religion or conscience. Vax mandates should be no exception. It's already terribly troubling that COVID survivors with natural immunity rarely receive medical waivers, even with letters from their physicians, arguing that vaccination could be counterproductive and unhealthy. Religious and conscience appeals, however, ought to be literally sacrosanct. This should be a matter of not only religion, but conscience. And it's incumbent upon critics and HR departments and governments to realize and honor this. In this nation, your conscience must remain sacred. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WOLDLP in Woodbridge, New Jersey, WHTY-AM in West Palm Beach, Florida, along with WYLF-AM in Panyan, New York. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.